Thank you. Really great talks. Not sure how I can follow this. I'm the outsider on the panel, and so I have been asked to give what I'm calling a friendly critique and talk. And I should begin by a disclaimer. This isn't the mandatory disclaimer that's at the end. I have no financial. This is a disclaimer to say that, although it was introduced, and I am very involved, I've been on the board of Healthcare for All for many years. Likewise, I'm on the board of its sister organization, Health Law Advocates, and has worked with Health Law Advocates in a legal capacity vis-a-vis the Connector and others. I'm speaking here totally on my own. I don't represent these organizations here today. I represent only me, myself, and I. So I want to begin with by giving a little bit of context. You've heard a lot about how we got to where we are today in Chapter 224 and a lot about what it does. I'm just going to make a few points that I think are important for the critique going forward. I'm going to mention some features, some notable features in the law that I think are worth applauding, perhaps, and then I'm going to focus on some concerns, and that's the crux of my talk, and they relate to what I would call the issue of consolidation, which we've already heard a lot about, what I call contradictions, internal contradictions within the law, and then the power of this regulatory body, HPC, which I serve so well. It has so many responsibilities, but I would suggest perhaps not quite as much power as it might need to do what it's going to do. So begin with the context. We've already heard this. Celia told us we now have the lowest rate of uninsurance in the country, and that is really important. That came from Chapter 58, but we also had very low rates compared to the rest of the country going in. But Chapter 58 really pushed us to this almost universal insurance. We're not there totally, I should say, because it's something I've been working on a lot right now. We're never going to get to universal insurance until this country wraps its head around the fact that we have a lot of undocumented people living among us, and they're really still left outside of the system. But still, the levels of insurance in Massachusetts are important and explain really, it lays the foundation for everything we're doing. Second point is, of course, and we've already heard this, so I won't go through this in much detail, but we have higher health care costs than the rest of the country. I think it's important to note that that's true even if you adjust for the fact that Massachusetts is relatively quite a wealthy state. Even if you adjust for that and adjust for age, our spending here is higher than elsewhere. Another point, though, that I don't think has been made perhaps as clearly as it could be is that healthcare is the local industry, right? I mean, if the auto industry is the industry in Detroit and Silicon Valley is about tech, well, we're about healthcare here. The Bureau of Labor Statistics say that over 700,000 workers in Massachusetts are in education and healthcare. But I think it's also interesting to note that the five largest employers in the city we are now in, of the five, four are healthcare, right? Brigham and Women's Hospital, Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston University School of Medicine, Children's Hospital. Not surprisingly, all projections are that healthcare is going to continue to be one of the largest growth industries in the area, and much of the projected job growth in the Massachusetts economy, especially if you look at the higher end professional jobs, are expected to be in healthcare and in biotech. As a result, healthcare costs. Right. We spent a lot of time talking about healthcare costs as a problem, and the slide showed it is a problem. It's a problem to employers. It's a problem for patients. It's a problem for the state government. It's squeezing out other things. But we need to also understand that healthcare costs one person's cost is another person's income. And that creates a problem. That's true nationwide. But in Massachusetts, it's especially salient to note. Cutting healthcare costs, dramatic deductions in healthcare costs would be dramatic deductions in income. And the healthcare industry is very powerful here, right? Lots of workers work in the industry. They are the major employers in town. So, what does Chapter 224 do? I'm not going to go through all of the features you've seen in great detail. I want to note a couple of particularly important points. First, and I think this is really worth noting, it tackles healthcare costs without limiting access. We can go over and think about healthcare bills for the last 25 years. In Massachusetts and in the United States, much of what goes by the name of cost containment, or what has gone by the name of cost containment in this country and in this Commonwealth, is really cutting access. I mean, that's one way we save government health care costs. We cut the Medicaid rolls, right? We've done that. We even cut Comcare in 2009. I mean, that's one way we do it. Or we cut benefits. We cut back on benefits. And Massachusetts has done this. You know, we've had good years. We expand the Medicaid basket, and in bad years, we cut it back. We get rid of dental benefits. We do these things. This is also trying to do it without cost shifting, right? Without putting much more patients' skin in the game, right? Which is another way we often cut costs, is really cutting costs to employers or insurers, but putting them onto patients. Instead, Chapter 224 looks to reform the delivery and payment systems and not necessarily reduce healthcare benefits or increase costs to consumers. I want to note a few other promising features, in my view. One is transparency. We've heard a lot about transparency. There's transparency to consumers, and there's transparency to the state. That's fabulous. Being against transparency is like being against apple pie or motherhood or the 4th of July. No one's against transparency. On the other hand, I think it's worth noting that there's not a lot of evidence that transparency makes a huge amount of difference. You can't find it in the literature. I mean, we know this in public health too, right? You know, just listing the calories in the back of the package doesn't make a whole lot of difference. And we know it in campaign financing, right? Transparency alone may not be a very powerful tool, although why not, right? There's support for innovation in payment methods, and we know the system's broke, so innovation is good. There's this medical malpractice feature which supports and provides basically a safe harbor for apologies. Again, fabulous. We know that patients want apologies. There's not a lot of evidence that this is going to do anything to improve quality of care, reduce costs, even reduce litigation, but it's good. It's good. And then there's support for population-level public health. And there's about $45 million over 4 years of just pure public health, not through clinical services. One of the things I want to note about all this is if you look at all the various things that Chapter 224 does, there's a way in which this is a lot like the ACA, right? There's a grab bag feeling of a lot of different features, and I want to get back to that in a second. So my three concerns: concentration, inherent contradictions, and lack of regulatory power. Well, we've already heard that the Massachusetts market is highly concentrated, and that really is an understatement, right? Massachusetts residents rely more on academic medical centers than people in other states. Take a visit, go right near my office, walk down Francis Street and Longwood Ave, and you are truly in the medical mecca of planet Earth. You know, there are more high-tech, high-intensity healthcare services being offered there than probably anywhere else in a few block area. It's really amazing.
And not surprisingly, the largest and highest paid hospitals are our academic medical centers. It's really hard to see this, but if you look all the way at the right, those are the highest cost hospitals in Massachusetts. And, you know, no surprise, it's Massachusetts General and Brigham and Women's Hospital, both of whom are part of a consolidated group known by Partners that owns a lot of the other places on this list. So we have these academic centers, they're consolidated, they're in partnerships with others, and they are the highest cost facilities. And they, as has been said, they are gaining market share at the expense of lower priced hospitals over the years. Hospitals are not the only consolidated areas of concentration. We already heard that the oligopoly is bilateral, and it is. Massachusetts is a pretty unique market in that we really have only a handful of payers. And these are the private payers. It doesn't include public payers like Medicare. But we don't have a million different insurance plans. 45% of the market is Blue Cross Blue Shield. 20% is
not for profit.
Okay. Very concentrated insurance market. So what does Chapter 224 do vis-a-vis consolidation? Well, we already heard that there's some regulatory oversight, right? That the HBC has to be informed about transactions that may affect the market concentration, that they perform cost and market studies, and that they can refer to the AGA's office, okay? And as was just told, transparency. Yeah, and I want to say that's great, but there's really, as was said, no regulatory power to stop concentration and consolidations that will increase concentration. And I want to note something else. The complexity of the regulatory reporting and transparency structures of Chapter 224 may themselves be a spur to consolidation. Or at least I want to throw out that possibility. We know from sort of, you know, the history and what we know about regulations nationwide, regulations can form barriers to entry. Regulations that are as complex, reporting requirements that are as numerous as what we see in 24, make it hard for small providers, small players to enter and thrive in the market. Right? There is a, you know, how do you handle all this? How do you do all this? You consolidate. Okay? And so although there's a recognition about concern about concentration, the very structure of the regulatory scheme actually may form and is an unintentional incentivization of consolidation. In addition, alternative payment methods, which the Act also tries to, support, are additionally spurs to consolidation, right? What are ACOs? On the one hand, they're integrated delivery systems, and that's fabulous. On the other hand, they are, of course, forms of consolidated care. And small individual players don't do ACOs. ACOs and all of these other structures that we're trying to incentivize may actually lead to the consolidation of the market. And I don't think it's surprising right now that we're seeing a lot of mergers coming forth at the same time that we're seeing a lot of ACOs. And I should note here that much of what I'm saying about 224 here, again, this criticism could be leveled at the ACA. Right, it's going in the same direction here. I also talk about contradictions, right? And I think, that it's important to recognize that there are some inherent contradictions in the regulatory philosophy, if I can call it that, of Chapter 224. And again, some of them are in the ACA. And I like this quote from the New England Journal of Medicine last August. Efforts to promote integrated, coordinated care, however, can generate incentives for provider consolidation that may reduce competition, right? So we want to reduce costs, but we also want to consolidate. That reduces competition, and yet we know, of course, that consolidation leads to higher costs. But also think about transparency, right? So we're going to have all these websites, if we can get them to work, and I say they're not so easy to find all this information, but we have all these websites where consumers are going to be able to figure out the cost of this and the cost of that and the report card for this and the report card for that. And the theory is that that will help lower costs because consumers will be, right, prudent shoppers. But that theory works completely against the idea of alternative payment methods and integrated care, right? If I'm in an integrated delivery system, if I have a medical home or I'm in an ACO, for those to work, in fact, I need to stay within that system. And if I stay within that system, then all that information that if I actually travel 100 miles, I could save $59 or $159 by going outside the system works against me. We want people to be in integrated delivery systems. That's great. That may be a lot better for the coordination of care. But understand that it's at odds with the idea of transparency. Right? Transparency assumes that there's consumer choice and flexibility, right? Openness to the market. And that's different than the integrated systems. And so I want to suggest that there's some inherent contradictions in Chapter 224. I want to also talk about lack of regulatory power. The benchmarks are great, but from some people's perspectives, they're not low. They're relatively low. What I think more important is there aren't a lot of mandates in this law other than the provision of information. In addition, and this really hasn't been emphasized, the penalties, I mean, we talked about toothless. The penalties really are laughingly low, right? So notice what happens if a provider does not meet the goals, if the HPC finds that the provider is not doing what it should do, it can be required to come up with an improvement plan. At the end of the day, if it refuses to do it or the plan it comes up with is not acceptable, what is the penalty? $500,000. Think about Partners Healthcare. I mean, $500,000 for Partners Healthcare is kind of like, well, it's probably less than if I got a parking ticket, for me, getting a parking ticket out here. It's incredibly low. And the theory, of course, is that this is not actually a law that is designed to work through mandates and penalties. Rather, I think it really is a law that is designed to work by, and it can be understood from what we were told at the beginning, a bipartisan coalition, a partnership. This is Massachusetts. We have a consolidated market. We bring a few people in together, and they work together. And that's great, and that is probably why we were able to have Chapter 58. The fact that we did not have a competitive marketplace, the fact that it was not a highly adversarial marketplace, that payers and employers and state regulators and consumer advocates and providers could all sit around the table and they all knew each other and they all go out to lunch together, it helps us get things done. We don't have the rancorous, gridlocked atmosphere that we have in Washington. But on the other hand, since it's my job to say the other hand is that that's awfully cozy. And it's hard to imagine that in that situation, that the regulators, given the lack of teeth in the statute, can really push the regulated all that far. First of all, the regulators have to rely on the regulated to get all this information, but really, do they have the capacity to audit it? Does your staff of 26? How much, right, there's a dependency on the regulated industry, and because they can only cut, you know, nudge, they can't hammer, right, there is a high potential for capture. And so I think we have, you know, the question really remains, can we expect significant changes, changes that might actually be hard on the regulated industry, the company, you know, the company employer, the town employer, can we really expect those kind of changes to come forward? So I think the jury is still out. Implementation will be the key. We don't know whether the regulators will be able to successfully regulate a powerful and concentrated industry. And when I say powerful, I really want to also emphasize politically powerful. We don't know whether transparency will actually make a difference. We don't know whether alternative payment methods will reduce costs. And we don't know whether the conflicting and contradictory aims within Chapter 224 will complement each other or they will actually undercut each other. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question.